think again, there's a tension here on the one hand about how the school can become more innovative in training leaders from amongst its own staff, which in my experience is being the most successful response to this challenge. But that has to be the tension there between how well the profession of schooling is regarded, you know, in the nation as a whole. And that, again, changes from country to country. How far can we raise the status of education in different countries? The third trend is to do with governance. And again, I've sort of tried to begin to sort of encapsulate or talk about that in terms of how increasingly national governments will set standards, set expectations for their schools, but at the same time, they will be devolving increasing responsibility to the school leaders to manage resource and to manage staff. How do you actually manage those tensions, and what does that actually mean for local democracy for schools? The fourth trend is to do with the personalization of learning. Again, I think that increasingly schools are going to be held account for how well they enable every young person to reach their potential. And it seems to me here that the tension is how do we as a school provide for more sort of individual pathways in terms of the curriculum for young people. So how can we actually manage their academic life in a more precise way? But then also, how can we actually take care of their broader needs as young people as they grow and develop and become members of the society? So again, it's a tension between standards of achievement on the one hand and developing the whole child, the whole person on the other. Seems to me, again, very, very clear if we're going to achieve all of those things, then there has to be, there will be an increasing trend towards the professionalism of our staff in schools, and the responsibility will increasingly come on the school director to actually make the school a place of learning for his or her teachers, as well as a place of learning for their students. What are the structures that need to be put into place to ensure effective learning for teachers? And can we also begin to develop a broader and a richer debate about the nature of teaching practice? Before we came in here, I was having a conversation with Joseph and with Marta in the front here about the nature of teaching, and saying, in my experience, all around the world, teaching tends to be a very individualized activity. Teachers do it inside their own classrooms, and they try to keep the doors closed for as long as they possibly can. If we're really going to personalized learning for young people, if we're really going to actually transform the quality of learning in our schools, there must be a much broader debate about the nature of teaching practice. So individual teachers inside a school can have an agreement on the most effective practices, and they hold each other accountable for the exercise of those practices. Now that's a major cultural shift in most schools, in most countries that I'm familiar with, but it is absolutely necessary if we want to actually transform the nature of learning in our societies. And the sixth trend is to do with the training of school leaders. It seems to me that the skill set required of school leaders, of directors, is very different from the skill set required of a teacher. Do we train school leaders specifically in those management skills? Do you create a college for leadership in Catalonia? What standards do you set for this? how do you actually match the standards with the individual needs of the school leader? All of those are strong tensions. So what I've tried to do in this second part of the presentation is to take the broader context of the OECD study, but to try and sharpen some of the trends and some of the tensions that innovative school leaders will be trying to resolve over the next 10 to 15 years. I think that there's some issues there which relate to your new law, which is trying to grapple with some of these tensions. There's no correct way. There will always be tensions in education. And the challenge is, how do you resolve those tensions in the context in which you live? All right, I'll be talking in a few minutes now about some principles underlying effective leadership. But always, these principles need to be adapted to the context here in Barcelona, the culture here in Catalonia as well. So let me now try and shift the focus a little bit more onto what are the most effective leadership practices that we see in the most outstanding school leaders that are currently working at the present time. And I want to draw now on a research study that we have just completed with three or four English universities and also a Canadian university in Toronto, where we've tried to track the behaviours of those school leaders that really make a difference to the quality of learning inside their schools. And we've done this in a number of different ways, and I think it's important just to tell you the methodology that we used. We first of all started with an analysis of all the English-speaking research studies and many of the non-English sources of research on effective leadership and how that relates to student performance. We then, out of that research, developed a model of a theoretical model, and we constructed a questionnaire which we sent to thousands of head teachers and teachers in English schools. We then identified 20 schools, and we were able to do this in England because we have very good data on the performance of our students. We were able to identify 20 schools, half of whom had been very low performing and then became, over a period of up to 5 years, quite high performing and sustained that level of performance, or they'd come from being average levels of performance and sustain that. And we spent 2 years in those schools trying to understand some of the dynamics. So I think this is good science, all right? We try to build our models on what was previously known. We then tested that model in a quantitative and statistical way, and then we spent a lot of time in those schools, really trying to understand the dynamics. I want to share some of that with you because I think it gives you a little bit of an insight in the type of people that you want to have in order to respond to the challenges that I've just been talking about. Well, the first thing we did, as I said, was to review the literature on school leadership, and we came up with a very long book on this, but we have summarized this into 7 strong claims about school leadership, which is the title of that slide. If you're interested in that, we have a 12 or 15 page paper on that, which is downloadable from my website if you go into it. I just want to pick out some of the key issues here. Not all of them, but some of the key ones. The first is that school leadership is second only to classroom instruction as an influence on student learning. All right? That is now absolutely clear. Yes, we need high-quality teachers, but it is also then the leadership in the school that actually enables that high quality to impact upon student learning. Now, of course, this is not the fact that the principal or the director him or herself actually teaches. It is the sort of the fourth bullet point there, that it is the way in which the school leader creates the conditions inside the school that allows highly effective teachers to actually impact upon their students. The second point that's worth pulling out from this list is that there is almost all school leaders draw on the same basic repertoire of leadership practices. Right? So if you look around the world, effective school leaders are doing the same sorts of things. Right? Now, this is not to say that there is a silver bullet in leadership, that all you have to do is to read one of my books and all will be well, all right? Because these principles, these basic practices, have to be enacted according to the context in which the leader is operating, all right? So, yes, it will look different depending upon whether you are in an inner city school here in Barcelona, whether you are in a rural school. It'll look different as whether you're in a high socioeconomic background or a low socioeconomic background. But when you actually look down at the basic practices, there's a high degree of similarity to them, although they are adapted to the context in which the school leader is working. And we can perhaps debate that at question time at the end as well. And then the final comment, the final point I want to pull out here is this last one, that there now seems to be a small handful of personal qualities that explain a high proportion of the variation in leadership effectiveness. Now, the models we've had previously of effective leadership have often been very sort of male-dominated. The charismatic leader charging across the plains of Catalonia on a white horse to save education, to save schooling. Right? You're getting that image, a very sort of testosterone-fueled approach to school leadership. Now, that doesn't seem to actually hold up empirically. It may hold up in popular newspapers or popular television series, but empirically it doesn't seem to be true. And what we're beginning to find out is those outstanding school leaders who can address the challenges that I've just been describing can actually create the conditions where young people can reach their potential, are sort of open-minded, flexible, persistent, optimistic, quite sort of self-conscious individuals, rather than the charismatic leader that we've been led to believe. So it was on the basis of that literature that we developed our statistical model. And I'm not going to talk that. That just proves to you that I'm a real professor, and we use statistics and do modelling. But it is a fairly complex set of variables that we were dealing with. And we were really helped in doing that by the level of information we have on individual students in the English system. But perhaps more accessible is this diagram here. And I want to try and take you through this diagram because I think this is a more understandable explanation of the impact of leadership on student learning. And I'm going to take you through from left to right, okay? So here in this column here is the column to do with the leadership capability, the leadership characteristics of the director and his or her senior colleagues. And you know, that should not be underestimated. People come with a personality, with a set of skills. They will have been in a job for a number of years. All of those are variables which impact upon their performance. Right? But then, of course, the leadership is exercised in a particular school. Some schools are functioning well, some schools are functioning badly. some schools are big, some are small. Some are rural, some are urban. All right? Some have low levels of ethnic diversity. Some are teaching in 50 or 60 different languages are present inside the school. So the so you have the individual characteristics, and of course you have the context, which I was talking about. All right? And through that are the sort of the four areas of consistent practice, which seem to be the things which all school leaders, all successful school leaders do. They set the vision, they build the vision, they set the direction of the school. They develop the people inside the school, they develop their staff. They redesign the organization to make it fit for purpose. And then they manage the teaching and learning process. All right? So those are the behavioral activities that leaders do. They relate, of course, to the type of school that they're in. They relate, of course, to the capability, their own individual capability. Those behaviors impact upon what we call the school, what we call them, the conditions inside the school, the school-level conditions, the sort of the work culture, the organizational culture of the school. And there are things like ethos, culture, and climate. They do, if they're successful, they will change the climate, they will alter the practices of teachers, they will give them a stronger focus on teaching and learning, on pedagogy, and there will be a higher level of student and staff motivation. And it is those things which allow then the outcomes to occur. And the outcomes can be a range of outcomes. We have academic outcomes there. We have personal and social outcomes. We have behavioral, behavior, and also the more effective, the more sort of social aspects of schooling. So you see how the logic works here. I'm trying to develop a little bit of a model for you here. There's something about the individual training and personality, which then is conditioned by the culture, the type of school it's in. Then these are the things that they have some control over, and I'll go into a bit more detail on that in a minute. They result in a changed work culture, which then impacts upon the actual outcomes of students. So it's quite a complex, it's quite a complex schema, but I think we need to understand that if we really want to have school leaders who really transform the nature of the school. So let me just take you through then some of the key skills, some of the key activities which these outstanding school leaders exhibit. So in terms of building vision and setting direction, it normally seems to be the school director who is responsible for that. It is very rarely somebody else. And they also are quite strategic in the way they put that vision into practice. It's all very well having a nice vision to write a statement of where the school is going, but you have to be able to strategically operationalize that in quite concrete and day-to-day activities. That's one of the defining characteristics of an outstanding leader. The second area in which they focus is understanding and developing people. And one of the things that we found out, which I think is fairly new in terms of the evidence, is the importance of the leader in generating a sense of trust inside the school. All of these outstanding schools that have moved from very low to very high levels of performance and sustained that were quite trusting organizations. That doesn't mean they always agreed and were always holding hands, but deep down there was a level of trust and a level of professional commitment that everyone had bought into. And that part of that was a result of the ability of the school leader to create very effective forms of professional learning inside the school. That's a a vast topic, and you may have to invite me back again to engage in that. But there are forms of professional learning that can really make a difference, and forms of, you know, professional development which have no impact upon classroom practice at all. And it's creating those conditions inside the school which seem to be very, very important. I'm happy to debate that later as well. There is something to do with organizational redesign, but the redesign is to support the learning of students. And most of the schools we've looked at have tried to alter the organization to more precisely support the learning of students. And part of this is the distribution of leadership inside the school. Another part of this is giving students more autonomy and more responsibility for running the school as well. And then the focus on teaching and learning. Let's let me pick out a couple of these. The fourth point there is to do with developing the range of teaching and learning strategies that teachers have. So to actually talk about the different strategies that teachers employ to elicit different learning responses from young people. And to also remember that a good teaching strategy can also be a good learning strategy. If you use, you know, collaborative group work, then you're teaching young people social skills as well as it being a more effective form of instruction. And the other point I want to bring out here is also the importance of teachers reflecting upon the progress of young people, using the data they have on student performance, feeding that back to the students, so the students take more control of their own learning as well. That seems to be an increasingly important feature of highly effective schools. So, if I want to summarize this, if I can pull this down, I've got 7 points there. I'm only going to talk to the first three of them. The conclusions I'm drawing from this is that certain leadership practices seem to be effective in all contexts, and those are the ones I've just described. Secondly, however, the leadership levers may be the same, but they are utilized differently in different contexts. All right? So they will look different depending upon the context of the school. But the third point is, and this is one which I think is really interesting, is that leaders will shift strategies as the school begins to progress. All right? And I want to try and explain that through the use of another diagram, if I can. And I'm sorry, this is, again, you're not going to be able to, well, you don't read English anyway, most of you, so it doesn't really matter. But this is, for me, a very important diagram. I just want to talk you through the flow of action here. And I'm going to use an example. This is an example, but it is a general example. All of the schools we saw followed this same type of pattern. But this is a school director. Her name is Diana. And she is the director of a primary school in a very disadvantaged and very socially dislocated part of Nottingham in the middle of England. All right? There's more gun crime in Nottingham than in most places in London. Okay, I'll explain that in a minute. When Diana, is it okay? Can I move over here? Is the camera all right if I move over here? Just for this? Is that all right? Oh, I have anyway. Diana took over the school in 1999. The school had been told by our inspectors that it was a failing school. They had, the previous director had resigned the school, and she came in as the new director. And in England, if you are called a failing school, that isn't much fun. You're in the newspapers, you know, school fails in the newspapers, and you have 1 year to actually change the situation around. So there is a great deal of pressure on the school director to work very hard with a group of staff who actually performed in such a poor way that the school was deemed to be failing in the first place and were also not very happy because their names have been in all the local newspapers, all right? So it's not an easy situation. But there were a number of things which Diana did in order to actually stop the school being failing. She did actually set direction, said, we're all going to do this, we're buying into the vision of the school. She became very directive in terms of a limited number of teaching strategies that were utilized across the school, consistently across the school. She established a behavior policy for the students. She made the school environment secure, and she spent a lot of time inside lessons supporting the teachers, ensuring consistency of practice. So there was a very narrow focus, quite top-down ways of working. Within a period of a year and a half, the school was regarded within 2 years, the school was regarded by our inspectors as being very good. Right? We have a four-part scale. Failing, satisfactory, very good, excellent. So she'd moved it from the bottom up to the second. But what she did was then, having got the shift, she then began to expand the mission of the school. She actually began to distribute the leadership inside the school more. She tried to make the school what she called a more thinking school. She actually had broader and richer forms of teacher learning going on in the school. Do you see what she was doing? She built the foundations here and then began to give more responsibility to staff in the second phase of work. In the third phase of work, she called that developing creativity, where she began to get a much richer learning environment for her students. School was then regarded as being outstanding by our inspectors. And in the fourth phase of work, she began then to do more networking, more outreach work with schools in the local area and the schools nationally. Now, this pattern of moving from a failing situation by being quite directive, quite top-down, ensuring consistency, then increasingly giving ownership to her staff, developing creativity inside the school, and then beginning to partner with increasing numbers of schools, is the pattern we've seen across all of the schools that we have been researching. Seems to be a very, very consistent pattern. But you can't get to there without starting there. And then what we did was to plot on top of that the academic results of the school and the results of the school inspections. And I've already said how the inspectors said it was failing here, very good here, outstanding here. But these are all marked, these coloured lines here, are the lines which reflect the performance of 11-year-old students inside the school on national tests. And this, again, I think is very, very interesting, because it proved to be, and this is a really tough school, all right? This is a very, very tough school. But she found it easy, by using those strategies, to actually get quite a rapid increase in national testing results. We find that you can do this in about 2 years with the right leadership practices. But then it took a lot longer to actually sustain that, to get a broader, richer curriculum and learning experience for the students. So you can get an increase in results, yes, but it takes a bit longer to embed that, to really get the full creativity in terms of the learning, of the students. And that is really important if you want to sustain success, if you really want to create citizens of the future. Just one, you may be looking at this, you may say, oh, there was a dip down there. And this was the maths examination in 2004. Diana is not defensive about this, but she does say that on the day of that examination, a drug dealer was shot dead outside of the school in the full view of the students. She thought that perhaps that had something to do with the dip in examination results. It also is an example of some of the challenges that our school leaders in your country, in your city, and in my country face. And I think they do a really outstanding job as a consequence of that. So that's the end of my third sort of my third section of the presentation. Am I okay for time? What time do you want me to finish? Fine. Okay. 10 minutes and then you're free, all right? I'm so sorry about this. But I wanted to, you know, what I've tried to do is to set up the OECD, the global context of leadership. I've tried to drive down a little bit on the sort of the more specific challenges and tensions that school leaders face. I've tried to give you an insight here of the practices that outstanding leaders tend to use. And I've used, you know, my own research, but I think it's... I spend a lot of time in many different countries. It seems to, you know, have a more general applicability. And I want to finish, I will finish, by talking a bit more now about the whole system context. How can we put leadership into a more systemic educational context? And I'm going to propose here a slightly different form of leadership, which I want to sort of leave with you. And that we can debate. But I think in this last analysis is something I think quite exciting about how leadership could not just transform an individual school, but could actually transform a whole educational system. In my recent book, or one of my recent books called Every School a Great School, and the reason I chose that title was I believe that every school can in fact be a great school. I try to give an analysis of system-level reform. And it's actually very similar to the analysis I've just done of Diana's school in Nottingham. Because if you take sort of time coming from this corner here across to here, if you really want to improve a school system, you have to engage in the early stages in quite a lot of top-down change. Now, this is not to say that there's, you know, the whole basis of this diagram and basis of this analysis is that the top-down change doesn't work by itself, nor does bottom-up change. The two have to go into balance, they have to be in balance. If you want to improve a whole system, you may need to start, like we did in England in the 1990s, with a high degree of top-down change, of national prescription. But then, over time, you need then to actually rebalance that and to give increasing autonomy to schools, right? And the challenge for policymakers, the challenge who are managing a whole system, the challenge for leaders inside schools is how you rebalance over time. And I gave you an example of how Diana did that in her own school. If you read my book, you'll get a sense of how we try to do that for the whole school system in England. But it does require, I think, the focus on a number of key policy issues, the learning, the professionalisation of teaching, the way in which we balance internal and external accountability, and the ways that schools collaborate together. But these link together.